Hi, this is Sharon Glover, and I want to welcome you to the S-Zone, where we talk strategies and solutions for everyday life and business. I'm super excited today and have a great guest for you. Stay tuned.
Well, first of all, again, I just want to thank you, Ian, for being here with me today. For those that don't know who we're speaking to, this is Ian, and he is, I'm going to let you, I know you were Essential Tennis, and I want to make sure I say that right and get all that right, and you have this very compelling bio of all the things that you've done. I loved when I read your information on LinkedIn on how you are lifelong tennis lover turned content creator. So that just sounds so interesting to me. So I just want to start off by asking you if you would just share a little bit of your journey, and maybe you can start with your tennis journey, and then you can share a little bit about the business journey.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah, I started, first of all, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it. Always enjoyable to talk about the kind of the crossroads between tennis and business and self-development and improvement, and all those sorts of topics are fascinating to me. So really happy to be here. But yeah, I started tennis as a pastime as a 10-year-old, 11-year-old, just playing at local public park courts. And I'm not exactly sure why I gravitated so strongly towards it, but before too long, by the time I was 12, 13, I really just had to play. I had to figure out how I could be on the court as much as possible. And it just resonated with me and my personality so strongly. And so by the time I got into high school, I was thinking down the road, okay, how can I make this what I do? How can I figure out how to get paid to be on a tennis court? And I figured out how to make that happen in a traditional sense. I played high school tennis, college tennis, went to a school that had a professional tennis management degree, which was fantastic. So that kind of kickstarted me down the traditional tennis coaching path in a club. And that was fantastic for a while, but I started getting frustrated by the students that I did have that were there kind of primarily for social and exercise. And that's fine. Like, it's great. If that's what people want to get out of tennis, it's fantastic. I'm grateful for every person who participates in our sport, but it's not why I was there. And it's not how I wanted to spend my time, was like facilitating activity hour or like babysitting, you know, kids that really didn't want to be there at all. It was their parents that were pushing them onto the court. So ultimately that's kind of what drove me to start creating content, was in mid to late kind of 2000s, 2006, 7, 8, podcasts started getting somewhat popular. And I saw people that had an area of expertise or knowledge. They were building an audience around that area of expertise and monetizing that audience. And I didn't see anybody doing that in tennis. And so long story short, that's kind of what prompted me to start doing my own podcast in 2008. And by 2011, I was able to quit my normal coaching job to start doing content full time. So that's it in a nutshell. And I'm really grateful to be where I am right now.
Wow. That is an incredible story and journey. It's so much what you said really resonated with me, because I actually began the sport really as an adult. I had a few touches with it, maybe in high school, but not enough to really connect with it. But as an adult, I learned how to play. And like yourself, it's such a passion. It became such a passion. And I was in the sport and I was playing. And then I was out of the sport for a little bit. Actually started my business, not Business Women Love Tennis, this brand, but started my business. And you know how we do, like we're grinding, we're trying to make things work. And that was one of the things that I took out of my life. And when I came back up for air, I was like, what did you do? What did you do? Because tennis offers so many different things, the recreation, the physical, the social, all of those elements. And I know I wanted to incorporate it back into my life. And then I realized I just want to play tennis. Like, I love this so much. How can I incorporate this into what I do? So as a strategist, it was just this aha moment. Like, business women love tennis. So we're bringing these two ideas of strategy and tennis together in a way to really inspire women, we say, to play their best game on and off the court. And we use these four principles of compete, connect, collaborate, and celebrate. So I love the things that you shared in terms of, because I know for me, yes, it's recreational, but if I'm going to be on a team and if I'm thinking business, I understand that there's an element of competition and competing, but not so much against the opponent. It's mostly about bringing our best selves. So this is what we say, particularly to women, like, you know, we want to bring our best selves. So I love that journey. And I am actually in awe at all of the content. So I would love to know, like, what that looks like. I thought it was really beautiful how you described that there was really no one in that particular area that was doing, that was really talking about tennis in that way. So if you could share a little more about that and as it relates to this idea of like having this niche, if you will, in a certain area in business and like what that did for you.
Yeah, lots of stuff there. Yeah, like I said, 2005, 2006, 2007, I had like an hour commute each way, and I hated the radio, just the commercials and all the ads, like, drove me crazy. So I found podcasts, which was incredible. Like, I could hear somebody talk about a topic I was interested in for my whole commute and just connect with that person and learn something and grow and have more knowledge in an area that I was interested in. And when I saw that nobody was doing it in tennis, it just seemed like a really obvious, to me, it seemed like a very obvious thing. Like, I talk about tennis all day. At that point, I was on a tennis court 8 hours a day, talking to people about how they can improve, how they can develop their skills. And so it seemed like an obvious pairing of content and that information that I was already delivering all day, every day to people who wanted to hear what I had to say. Thankfully, there were people that wanted to hear what I had to say. That all along is kind of the common denominator. So I started just by, I'm just in front of an iMac right now. We were renting a basement apartment, my wife and I opened up GarageBand, push record, and just talked to my iMac. And I started the podcast in early 2008. And that was my primary focus for a couple years. And I started writing a blog as well. Back in 2008, 2009, video was significantly harder than it is now. You can't just, you know, back then you can pick up your phone and shoot HD video and like upload it in 30 seconds. It was significantly more difficult than that. So I kind of put video on the back burner for the first couple years because I was working very hard on the court and I didn't really have a lot of free time. So audio was really easy, you know, low barrier to entry. Writing, you know, blogging, really low barrier to entry. So for my first couple of years, that was my primary focus. And it wasn't until, well, I started my YouTube channel in 2009, but it wasn't really till 2010, 2011 that I started putting a lot of effort and energy into that platform. It became obvious to me that in particular for a skill like tennis, that's so technical and people wanted to see, you know, patterns and strategies and positions and techniques and all those sorts of, they wanted to see, you know, me hit a ball. They wanted to see a student hit a ball, see a before and after, you know, side by side image. And so I started putting much, much more energy in the video side of things. And that's been the main focus for the last 10 years or so. So as of right now, I don't know what the total number is, but it's definitely north of 10,000 pieces of content. There's over 2,000 videos on our YouTube channel. There's over 2,000, it's probably over 3,000 videos now in our paid courses when you sign up for one of our paid courses online. And then blog posts, emails, podcasts, social media posts, easily another 5,000 pieces of content. So I've been real busy and along the way have built a following, and it's pretty much exactly what I was hoping would happen. So I feel really fortunate that it's actually worked out.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of how and when I discovered you, but I know it started, I believe it definitely started from YouTube. And then I went to the website and I was like, oh my gosh, look at all of this content. It was videos for days. And then I signed up and on your email list. And when I tell you, I love this content, I love your content. It is just, you see it, and from the subject line to the way that you talk to your audience. And that takes me back to something that you said a little bit earlier. It's not just this idea of like tennis, but it's tennis and self-development, personal development, and all these different elements. And that's, to me, one of the beautiful things. I believe that the skills are so transferable. So like there are many things that happening on the court that when I come back to the office and doing work, I have to remind myself, one, just very simple one, follow through. Yes. If I do that every time, on the court, off the court, I would significantly increase, you know, the results that I would get. So maybe just talk a little bit between like how you like merge those two things together, that just those transferable skills and in conjunction with just how you put your content together, because again, it's very powerful to read it and not just know that when you finish, you're going to have some information that will help you on the court, but also something that will maybe motivate you or inspire you to look at something a little bit differently, maybe in your business or your life.
Yeah, definitely. That's been a thread that's been woven through everything that I've done over the last decade, and a particularly interesting part of tennis for me. And I think a big reason why I resonated with it so strongly so early was it really is an allegory for the rest of life in so many ways. Coming face to face with an opponent or an adversary, even when that adversary might be yourself and not necessarily the other person across the net from you, figuring out how to problem solve that obstacle and find the best path forwards in real time, like while you're being challenged by that force, whether it's visible or invisible. And then figuring out how to reflect on that either failure or a success, learn from it, become smarter and wiser and more adaptable and successful down the road, you know, for the next time and the next time and the next time, not just in the moment, like all those kinds of themes. And then either celebrating, you know, the victory, which I'm bad at, and, you know, reflecting on what worked well and like what was successful, or in a lot of cases, being okay with mourning, you know, a loss, I think is equally important a lot of times, and allowing it to affect you. All of those things and many, many more are analogous, you know, back and forth. And then you've got other themes like fair play and being a good sportsman or sportswoman, being able to try your best and give a full effort with a good attitude, even when things aren't going your way. I mean, between the two of us, I'm sure we could make a bullet list of, you know, 1,000 different things that are important on the tennis court and all great tennis players have in common. And then when you take those elements and apply them to everyday life, whether it's career or relationships or self-care and like self-love and self-development, you know, dealing with family members, whatever, driving in traffic, you know, there's unlimited connections, and that's always fascinated me. And for that reason, the podcast, it's probably my least popular in terms of like numbers, as far as raw like downloads. It's probably my least popular piece of content, but it's my favorite because to me, it's the most logical place to connect those dots and really be philosophical and a little bit more woo-woo, you know, about that connection between tennis and the rest of life. And for that reason, when I go and work with people in different locations or when people fly here to Milwaukee to work with me, there's a unbelievably high percentage of the time when people spend a lot of effort or a lot of time or a lot of money to spend time with me, it almost always starts with, so I listened to your podcast. And so the level of connection on that level, you know, those topics is really high. And I'm really grateful for that, even though it's not like hundreds of thousands of like followers of the podcast, the connection there is really deep. And at the end of the day, you know, that's what's most fulfilling for me. If I can make a really, really small impact on somebody in terms of the rest of their life, in addition to their tennis, then that's definitely what I'm most grateful for.
Yeah. I really enjoyed hearing those various elements. There was one, and I wrote it down here. There are a few articles. One was the human connection of tennis. And as I shared earlier, you know, our four principles are to compete, connect, collaborate, and celebrate. And you talked about the celebrating too. And I think that's hard for a lot of us to remind ourselves, and not just the big wins, the small wins too. Those are just as important as well. And so just being able to, just hearing you talk about that is, I just love that. I would like to know, because you talked about, you do a lot of content creation, but you also still on the court. How do you blend those two together? Sounds like a really full day.
Yeah, it is. Well, I don't have days that I finish what I wanted to finish. And that's just become the norm for me. And I enjoy that pace, and I enjoy the challenge. There's a part of me now that enjoys going home, leaving things undone, because I know that I packed in as much as I, you know, possibly could that day. But I would say on during an average week, I probably spend about 75% of my time either planning or in production or in publishing of content, whether audio, written, or video. And that covers a lot of different, you know, steps in that process. Thankfully, I have two production people on staff that's all they do, is they edit and they publish and they, you know, prepare for whatever the next piece of content is. There's no way I could, the volume of stuff we're doing now, there's zero chance I could do it by myself. So that's probably 3/4 of my time. And then the other quarter, on average, in an average week, is actually working with students, whether it's one-on-one or in a group setting. Obviously these days it's all one-on-one. I haven't done a group in quite a while, but I'm grateful that I still have the ability to be out here on the court and work with people in person.
Yeah. And I was thinking about it as you talked about your production team, and of course the significance of, you know, having people that are working with you. And that goes back to me, this idea of collaboration. So can you speak a little bit about that, like that, the team effort as it relates to the business and on the court? I think about, my preference is doubles. I do play a little bit of singles when I can, but doubles, and, you know, it's all about like just working as a team, collaboration, and supporting each other and all of those things. So I would love to just hear your take on that from both perspectives.
Yeah. Sorry. When you say both perspectives from what are the two?
You know, as it relates to the team on the court and, you know, the team aspect or collaboration aspect in business.
Gotcha. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's critical for me. And this was a big turning point for me. 6 years ago, I up until that point had worn all the hats in my business of marketer, production, publishing, customer service, coaching, you know, content, you know, creator. I did everything myself, and I enjoyed it that way for several years. For 4 years, I did everything on my own, and I kind of liked it that way. But then I got to a point where the metrics were very clear that things were, or rather had, leveled out. And I knew that there's no way there was going to be any kind of significant growth unless there was a change in the amount of man hours, you know, just in terms of practical hours spent in a day on everything that has to happen to make essential tennis run. I knew that I basically had maxed myself out. And So it came to a point where I had to make a decision. Like, is just going to continue to just be the Ian show. And it was great. You know, I was supporting my family and basically reached all the initial goals that I set for myself. Or can I take the kind of leap of faith of trying to make it something bigger than what I can do by myself? And I'm really grateful that I made an effort to do that, because now through that collaborative process, I'm able to hand off individual hats to different people who specialize and have a personality and have skills and passions for those individual hats that I don't necessarily have. I don't have a passion for customer service, for example. I have somebody right now who does, and he's like, that's what he loves to do is connect with people, help people. Not that I don't like connecting or helping people, but I would much rather spend my time creating something that I know is going to impact 100,000 people over the next, you know, couple weeks, as opposed to opening an individual email and replying to an individual person about an individual problem because they couldn't copy and paste their password, you know, into the login square. Like, that's what he spends most of his day doing, and God bless him. Like, he actually enjoys doing that. So without his, you know, time and talent and passion, I would be tied down and I wouldn't be able to focus on what it is that I'm maybe uniquely good at doing. And so over the years, I've realized that there's a whole lot of humans out there that have a passion and a talent for things that I don't necessarily want to spend my time on. And that's always my goal when I bring somebody else on our team, is find the person who more than anything wants to spend their time doing this thing that we need help with, not somebody that can check the box and, you know, get it done. You know, any, you know, living, breathing, you know, person can check the box, but I have a passion for working with people who have a passion for what they're doing. And so building a team like that, where we can collaborate on a single, you know, kind of goal or purpose of changing the lives of as many people as possible through tennis, through doing each of our individual tasks, you know, really excellently. That's a really exciting and gratifying thing for me. So that's kind of the, you know, the business operations side of things. On the coaching or on the court side of things, for 6 years, I had at least one other coach with me full time, you know, day in and day out, making content, working with students. And that period actually just ended two months ago. Kevin and Megan left and took a job back in Tulsa in a more traditional coaching role. And so for the last 2 months, I've had to figure out how to be a solo creator and coach again, which has been a big transition for me. And I'm enjoying it a lot. The first month or so, I would say, was really tough because I was used to sharing the load in terms of the creation and the planning and the development, and also like the energy, you know, output of like actually doing all the delivery myself was a big transition. So the last 6 years, I'm really grateful to have the relationships I had with the other coaches was amazing. I learned a tremendous amount from them. It was the camaraderie and like the sharing and the experience of helping players break through and creating content, you know, that reached millions of people. Like, that's all fantastic, and I enjoyed it a lot. But I think I'm going to be back in a phase for a little while now of kind of focusing on myself again as a creator, as a coach, kind of pushing myself in a solo way. So I've experienced both ends of it, and I think there's big, you know, pros to doing it both ways, both in a collaborative way and also kind of focusing on yourself and developing your skills and abilities in more of a vacuum, I think is valuable too.
You said so many things there that resonated with me. I like the idea of just, so this month our theme is just Ace in August. And it's interesting that a lot of the things that I've been thinking about have been, it's always nice when you come up with something kind of catchy. So to me, when I think about connecting and connection, the first thing I think about is awareness and that self-awareness. And so you just sharing that and talking about that it's exciting to hear. And then the second thing, something you mentioned earlier that you just spoke about, was just this idea of adapting, having that adaptability. And so I think that's critical and important as well. So I think particularly as business owners, as entrepreneurs, I mean, we have to be like mindful of all those different things that that will help us get to the place that we're trying to be. Another one that I talked about was just accountability. And so that's just having accountability for yourself and maybe even having an accountability partner. So there's a lot, I think, to unpack there, but I would just like to hear from you in terms of your perspective as an entrepreneur dealing with all of the elements of what that takes. What's your process for acing it? Acing it in business, and I think acing it on the court as well.
Well, I like the word accountability a lot. I would say if I were to kind of break down everything that we do into like a really simple formulaic way of explaining it, at any given point in time, when we set out to accomplish something, whether it be publish a YouTube video or create a digital training program or work with somebody who comes here to try to fix their backhand or their serve, whatever it is, I would say in a very general way, we go through an evaluation phase where it's like, okay, what are we trying to accomplish here? What different pieces can each of the team members take to make it as successful as possible? And then there's like the creation or the actual implementation phase where we get behind the camera, we get behind the microphone, we stand in front of the student and deliver whatever it is that we're trying to communicate, whether it's a concept or a strategy or a technique or a explanation of here's why you're falling short of your goals right now. And here's the road we're going to take. Like, here's the process we're going to follow. And then there's the reflection side of things. What we do is very unique in that I don't do anything without it being recorded in a way that I can watch it back, and tens of thousands of people also watch it back. And for most people, I think that's probably a terrifying, like I literally don't do anything without it being recorded and then published so the rest of the world can watch it. And so that brings a very special kind of accountability, as you said. And so there's no hiding, for me. When I make a decision and I move forwards with it, if it's a video, like a YouTube video, we know within 2 hours of clicking the publish button if it's going to be like a huge success or a total dud and like nobody cares. When we launch a new online training program, we know within 24 hours of making it available for people to register, if it's going to support the business, financially and all of our families and children, or if nobody cares and nobody's going to sign up. And that's a real outcome. That happens. Like, we publish things that people don't care about, and it doesn't really make any impact because we just missed the mark. And with the student, it's very obvious if we take the right path or not. We're using an iPad and recording every single move that student makes. And an hour later, after we've done the analysis, we've done the explanation, we've kind of chosen our path, like we're gonna focus on this technical element, here's how we're gonna work on it, okay, let's work on it. An hour later, when I was in that kind of collaborative relationship with other coaches, we all know whether or not like we should have focused on something else, or wow, this is exactly the right thing. He's killing it. Like, he already like huge improvements, and it's very obvious to everybody whether it's a failure or a success. And I think I always try hard to avoid sounding condescending or but I think for most people in most normal roles and most more normal jobs, it's very easy to hide behind the system. and there's like, you know, the work that we do in that normal, you know, employee role, we can sit behind our desk and we can do those tasks. We can check those boxes. And there's kind of a buffer between the work that we're doing and the machine, you know, and like the macro direction and momentum that the machine has. But for me, there's no place to hide. Like everybody who's involved in my team sees the numbers, they see the views, they see the comments, they see the likes, they see the sales numbers. They see the before and after, you know, side by side images with the students. And so that to me is ultimate accountability. And at first that's really terrifying, but in time I've come to a place where it's very, very comforting, which probably sounds weird to a lot of people listening to this, but I know that I don't have to try to fool anybody. It's pointless for me to try to fake anything because everybody watching is going to know the moment I start trying to do that. And so after years of being on record and publishing everything, there's actually a very peaceful place for me where I know I'm giving my best effort. I know everybody else knows I'm giving my best effort. And when it kills it, then it's apparent to everybody that we all did a great job. And when it fails, that's a normal part of what we do. You know, we're not trying to avoid failure in the sense that we're trying to isolate ourselves from ever making a mistake. We have done it enough times now. It's not a big deal anymore. And we simply learn from it and adapt and move on to the next step. So sorry, that was a long answer, but I feel really strongly about that word, and I feel very, I guess, grateful, fortunate that I've gone down this path because it's forced me really to become the best version of myself possible, because I'm under the eye of, you know, the lens, and the microphone is always listening, and there's no place for me to hide.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. I loved it. The other word that I thought about was authenticity. And I think when we remind ourselves to be our authentic selves, whatever that looks like, and know that it doesn't mean that we're not going to mess up, as you said, we're not going to fail. And the importance of that. So as we begin to wrap up here, I wanted just to one thought about that, because you talked about the failure. And I know that can be a hard one for, particularly in the business world. And you wrote an article about, don't quit. Why I won't quit. And also I'm just thinking, particularly now in a time that has been really, really challenging for so many people and for so many businesses. So can you just share a thought, a word, or just something around that idea of just, you know, the feeling and the not quitting. and that's one of the reasons we wanted to talk about ACE in August, because we know that 2020 has been like, what the heck? But let's commit to ACE in August. Let's just do what we can. Let's pivot if we need to, if we haven't already. And let's just not quit. Let's give it all we have.
Yeah, man, there's a lot of books have been written just about that one question. There's definitely a lot there. First of all, I think it's very hard to do something meaningful and impactful that really makes a big difference in the lives of people when you do what is, when you follow a path that's already been laid out. In other words, if you do what people are expecting in the way they expect it, and in a way that's safe and comfortable, you're not ever going to do anything that's very impactful. Mm. And so I think embracing the unknown and the discomfort. I heard somebody on a podcast, sorry, I don't remember who it was. I'm sure you're familiar with the idea of imposter syndrome.
Yes. Yes.
Meaning like, who am I? Like, who am I to get behind this microphone or in front of this camera and say what I think? Like, do I really think I'm that big of a big shot that people actually give a crap about like what I have to say? And I heard somebody say something that was really profound. Maybe it was Seth Godin recently. Yeah, I think it was Seth Godin's podcast. He said that imposter syndrome is a fantastic indicator that you're doing the right thing. If you don't feel imposter syndrome, then either you've got a massive ego and not very much humility. Like, if you think that you're in the role that you're made for, then you're either not doing anything very challenging, or your ego is probably going to get in the way at some point. And so I remember, you know, early on feeling incredibly, you know, nervous all the time. And I made a pivot in my mind. I made a very conscious decision. I remember the moment that I made the decision, and I had the, you know, epiphany that, holy crap, like, every time I feel that feeling and I go do the thing to the best of my ability, on the other end of that experience, or on the other end of that effort, whatever it was, I always realized that that was the next like step forwards. Like, that was the next progression in what I need to do to reach my goals or get to where I'm trying to get. And so it got to a point after, you know, a year or two of awareness of that, where when I started feeling that sensation of anxiety or nervousness or what, you know, I don't know what's going to happen here. I could just look like an idiot in 10 seconds when this thing starts. All of a sudden it shifted from viewing it as something to be afraid of. And I started viewing it as something to be grateful for. And I started viewing it as something where I knew that this place is where I should be right now. Because if I went days or weeks or months without feeling that feeling, then I'm stuck. Like, I'm stagnant. I'm not doing anything very important anymore. So that's number one. And I think once you get over that initial like fear of the anxiety and the what ifs and like the imposter syndrome, once you realize that that's how you know, that's like the indication that you're doing important work, I think the next most important thing, a good friend of mine who's in the fitness space named Michael Morelli, got this phrase from him. He likes to say it's not failure, it's feedback. Meaning when you try something and it doesn't work, I think in particular in our Western like culture, we've been trained that when something doesn't work, it's a dead end. It's like, well, that's it, kid. Like, you gave it your best shot and you're done. I don't know if that's sports or if I don't know, like, competitive nature, you know, as Westerners, I'm not sure. But for me, as soon as I made that pivot from it being a failure, like that's the end of the line, or like you're walking away with like nothing positive from the experience other than you're a loser. And I started viewing it through the lens of, you know, Thomas Edison. What, I don't remember the number exactly, but he was quoted as saying, it's not that I failed to invent the light bulb. I just found 2,000 ways that didn't work.
Yes.
And I think that mentality, if you're going to try to be an entrepreneur, or if you're going to try to be good at tennis, there's a billion ways to mess up tennis. And if you view the messing up of those different things as failures, you're going to walk off the tennis court feeling like a failure every time you play the game.
Right.
And I'm not saying that in like a some kind of allegory, or, you know, like, I mean literally, like, not figuratively. You're going to walk off the court feeling like a failure every time you play tennis. If when you make a mistake, it means to you that that you're a loser or you're a failure. Because you're never going to play without making a mistake, ever. Roger Federer never plays without making a mistake. Serena Williams never plays without making a mistake. So I think viewing those errors as feedback and as learning opportunities may be the most important thing, because otherwise you just end up feeling more and more and more and more depressed about what it is that you're doing, instead of the flip side is pivoting a little bit each time and becoming more and more and more effective every time that you make a mistake.
Wow, that was great. That was awesome. I have lots of notes. Thank you for that. I think that's super important. I do think we all suffer from that, the imposter syndrome. I was actually having a conversation with a client of mine. We made a whole campaign around it. It was like, we're going to address this. We're going to just, if you're asking the question, who am I? Let's just build a whole campaign around it. So I'm hearing a lot of confirmation, a lot of great information, just in terms of how we can continue to be as effective as possible on the court, how we can continue to compete, to connect, to collaborate, and to celebrate. And so again, I just really want to thank you so much for the insight that you've shared today with me. And I would love it if you would just share with everyone that's listening, just how they can reach you, how they can find out more, watch your videos, purchase courses and those things, anything you want to highlight, if you have anything special right now going on that you want to share, just want to give you that opportunity before we wrap up.
Well, thanks. I think these conversations can only be as good as the questions that are asked. So you did a fantastic job. I enjoyed the conversation very much. These are exactly the type of topics that I love discussing, and frankly, I don't have a big opportunity to discuss them very often. Like, no, I spend 99.9% of my time in the stuff, you know, doing the things. So it's nice to come up once in a while and actually reflect on the process. It's a lot of fun for me. On the audio side of things, definitely the Essential Tennis Podcast. Wherever people listen to podcasts, Google Podcasts or Apple Podcasts, probably the easiest place. And on the video side of things, the YouTube channel is definitely the top place for us right now, youtube.com/essentialtennis. And that's about it. Those are the best resources. If you want to learn more, there's a contact page on our website, essentialtennis.com. That pretty much covers it.
And definitely get on the email list so you can get all of that. It's amazing. Well, thank you. Ian. Before we go, let me snap a quick picture.
Sure.
And let's see, I'm going to, let me just stop the recording here.